Alaska is the only Arctic state in the nation, and we are ground zero for climate impacts.
The Walker administration drafts a climate change strategy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a local telethon is hosted in opposition to President Trump's pick for Education Secretary.
We're busy the entire time, nonstop with phone calls. Alaskans really want their voices heard.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska state government can save money by privatizing some services at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API. But it doesn't look like it would save if it privatized all services. Consultants who studied the privatization for the state found that management of the institute, as well as operating the state's juvenile justice detention centers, are better done by the state. Senior consultant Coy Jones of Public Consulting Group says savings depend on how many patients are at the psychiatric institute.
There are some limited cases of privatization that we would recommend implementing. They're easy to do and they will generate some cost savings.
For example, the consultants recommend there could be savings in privatizing the institute's communication center. But a different consultant that looked at youth detention centers couldn't find any opportunities for privatization. Consultant Carl Becker of CGL, a consulting company that specializes in corrections, says local organizations operate juvenile facilities in other parts of the country. But local organizations weren't interested in operating the facilities in Kenai, Nome, and Palmer.
We found basically no private or governmental organizations in any of these regions that had either the interest or the capability to operate standalone detention facilities for these youth.
The state also couldn't find savings in privatizing pharmacy services at Pioneer Homes. The state studied privatizing services as a result of a new law that overhauled Medicaid in Alaska. The Senate Health and Social Services Committee held a hearing on the studies today. Climate change has always been a sticky issue for Alaska policymakers. As a state that sits on the front lines of global warming but remains deeply dependent on oil, it sometimes seems like the easiest option is just not talking about it at all. But now Governor Bill Walker and Democrats in the State House are considering some tentative steps to tackle the issue. As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, they're picking up where another Alaska governor left off.
The Walker administration has been sending signals for a couple of months now that it wants to develop a formal climate change policy. Here's how the governor put it in his State of the State speech in January.
Alaska is the only Arctic state in the nation, and we are ground zero for climate impacts. We must maintain the integrity of our lands, air, and water for future generations. My administration is developing a framework to engage Alaskans in this effort to protect our way of life.
In his speech, Walker sounded a lot like the last Alaska governor to tackle climate change, Sarah Palin.
As the largest and only Arctic state, we're also studying climate change through our DEC-led sub-cabinet.
That was Palin speaking in her last State of the State speech in 2009. Her sub-cabinet, essentially a working group of government officials, was the last major statewide policy effort on climate change. Larry Hardig chaired that effort as commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, a job he still has two governors later. He says when Alaska first started talking about climate change adaptation, they were way out in the vanguard.
I would go to meetings with other states or other countries, and I would be talking about adaptation, and they would look at me like I was doing something sinful or something.
Because talking about climate change was supposed to mean talking about stopping climate change by cutting greenhouse gas emissions.
It was like you were distracting people from the real work if you wanted to talk about how you're going to adapt to change, and you know, it's kind of like giving up.
Now, of course, nearly 10 years later, adapting to climate change is no longer an outlandish idea. Palin's subcabinet was supposed to draft a state climate strategy to deal with impacts, cut emissions, and triage the most threatened communities. Hardik says a lot of good work came out of that effort. You can still find the reports on the state website. But there was never any final strategy. Under Governor Sean Parnell, the focus shifted. The subcabinet is still on the books, but it last met in 2010. Now, Governor Walker is trying to revive that effort. He's tapped Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott to lead the way. So I asked Mallott, what's in the works?
Well, there is a climate policy process in the works. What's in it is a work in progress.
If that sounds vague, well, it is, and deliberately so. Mallott says he knows climate change is a touchy subject, and he's trying to get a lot of input before moving forward. He wants to get beyond the political debate over what causes climate change and focus on dealing with the impacts.
Because if I start from the place I believe it's human caused, then, you know, I've already begun to disengage from voices that believe differently, and they need to be heard.
Ultimately, he says the state needs to plan not only for environmental change, but for changes in international policy and the markets, which, Mallott says, are likely moving toward a low-carbon future, whether Alaska likes it or not. He's aiming to release something more concrete this spring. Meanwhile, Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson plans to introduce a climate bill in the State House within weeks. He says the issue has taken on a new urgency since the November election.
I think it's a higher priority because I don't have a White House anymore that cares. And that is profoundly concerning and frustrating. And so for the next 3 years and 11 and a half months, it's not going to come from the federal government.
Josephson says his bill will likely call for an outside commission to recommend specific legislation. He's also considering a climate change mitigation fund that would add a new tax on oil production to fund climate adaptation, things like evacuation roads or new schools for eroding villages. But there's less appetite in the Republican-controlled state Senate. Kathy Giesel of Anchorage is chair of the Senate Resources Committee. She says Alaska already taxes oil production to pay for infrastructure. That's basically how the state budget works. And she points out that Alaska has a different set of incentives than, say, California. In a state that still gets much of its revenue from oil, she says, if we want more money to deal with climate impacts, we need more oil production, not less.
Should we hamper Alaska in developing our financial means to handle these challenges? I think that it would be very short-sighted and imprudent.
Giesel says she has doubts about whether human activity is the main driver behind climate change, and she worries even discussing the issue opens up a dangerous can of worms.
Of course, we plan for change, but there are many folks that take this opportunity to advocate for completely shutting down our state, and that's the risk when you start opening this kind of conversation up.
Risky or not, for now at least, the conversation is back on the table. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Parents and activists who don't want to see Betsy DeVos confirmed as U.S. Education Secretary are hitting the streets and the phone lines around the country and in Alaska.
This is Parker with Students with a Voice.
Members of Great Alaska.
This is Gabby with Students with a Voice.
Would you like to work on your comments to Senator Sullivan?
Last week, Great Alaska Schools and Students with a Voice launched a homespun telethon in an Anchorage home, which they broadcast on Facebook Live. They say they took more than 1,000 calls. Gabby Requelma was one of scores of demonstrators who went to Senator Dan Sullivan's Anchorage office this afternoon to deliver reports of those calls.
We had 7 phone operators who were busy the entire time, nonstop with phone calls. Alaskans really want their voices heard, and I think Senator Sullivan really has, you know, an obligation to hear us out.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of only 2 Senate Republicans to come out against the DeVos nomination. Murkowski says DeVos hasn't demonstrated enough knowledge about public schools. Sullivan, though, says he'll vote for DeVos. In a written statement, he says she clearly cares deeply about America's children. Unless DeVos' opponents can pick up one more Republican senator, it's likely she will be confirmed in a vote tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after more than a year of preparation, a family-owned pot shop opens its doors.
I mean, this is a dream come true. This is
something that I never thought I would be doing in my life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
Alaska voters in the nation's northernmost town won't get a chance at the polls to repeal the community's newly reinstated Inupiaq name. The city council in Utqiagvik, the town formerly known as Barrow, voted 5-1 against the proposal by Mayor Fanny Sivlu last week. The new name is being challenged by a local Alaska Native corporation, which filed a civil lawsuit after the election. That case has not been yet resolved. Over the last few weeks, many Alaskans are experiencing something new walking into a store to buy pot. For more than a year, Alaska Public Media has been profiling one family cannabis business as they try to break into the new industry. Now, as Zachariah Hughes reports, they're finally open for business, but not without lingering concerns.
A two-person band plays in the corner as dozens of people chat, inspect glass pipes, and buy bags of pot. It's the soft opening for Enlighten Alaska, the latest in a handful of cannabis retailers to start in Anchorage. Standing behind a glass display case is an employee with tattoos and long hair dyed a faded shade of blue.
My name is Victoria Davis, and I am a bud tender here.
Bud tenders are salespeople. Davis's job is talking with customers to answer questions, whether that's a price check for a certain strain of pot or fielding inquiries about biochemistry. I'm here to shop, to see what it's like to make a purchase in Alaska's newest industry. When Davis gets a customer like me, who's not very familiar with cannabis, she starts with a few basic questions about what they want out of the drug.
Well, I ask them what they want to feel, if you're going to want to be sleepy or if you're going to smoke during the day. It just really depends on what you're looking to receive out of the benefits of cannabis as well.
Davis calls this consuming with intention. She got her start bud tending at a medical dispensary in Michigan and now is one of the 7 part-time employees working at Enlighten. The shop has a one-page menu of cannabis products that I stare at, not really sure which one's right for me. Davis shows me glass jars filled with assorted marijuana buds, each with different potencies and effects on mood, energy, and awareness.
I have Sensi Star and the Afghani Gooey. That's a straight indica as well, and those are going to be heavy hitters. Probably get the munchies from those.
Most of these strains cost $22 a gram, which, depending on quality and quantity, can be almost double what you might spend outside a legal business. But that extra money pays for testing, taxes to the state, security cameras, heating the store, and professional guidance from an employee like Davis, who holds a jar right up to my nose.
I think that one smells like pretty fresh. Almost like a Christmas tree, but not quite.
There are other products too. Edibles with names like Canna Crisps and Dank Chip Cookies sell for $15 to $25 a package, respectively. Concentrated oils run a bit higher. Under Davis's advice, I decide on a strain called Vanilla Kush, which is on the low end potency-wise, but I'm told a good fit for relaxing in front of a movie before bed.
That is 20. Would you like a receipt?
I have to pay in cash because marijuana businesses don't comply with federal banking laws. Davis tucks the small bag into a white plastic envelope with an elaborate childproof zipper. Overall, it's a very regulated purchase. My ID was checked twice, there's testing data all over the packaging, and I got a lot of advice from an employee about the thing I ultimately bought. Getting the business to this point, though, has not been easy.
I'd say the risk that we took was investing, you know, our retirement funds and everything that we have.
Leah Leventon is one of 3 owners of Enlighten, along with her brother and her mom. They estimate that getting to this day took more than $300,000, almost double what they'd planned for.
There's no option but to be a successful business.
Beyond just the financial difficulties, the family had a hard time getting their license application together, navigating the permitting process, and building out their shop. Leventon also had to keep her involvement in the cannabis industry under wraps for months while she finished up at her previous job, basically putting in a second shift after work most days.
It's called coming out green. I mean, this is a dream come true. This is something that I never thought I would be doing in my life.
Both she and her mother, Jane Stinson, know there are major challenges ahead. The overhead costs are high, and Stinson says there still isn't enough cannabis being legally grown in Alaska to restock stores like this one when they sell out.
If we could, we would buy a lot of product if it were available, because I know the market is there.
Enlighten benefits from starting a few weeks behind other Anchorage stores. They're open for just 6 hours, 3 days a week, rationing the product so that it's consistently available. Stinson says they've also gotten a glimpse from other retailers about what kinds of products people are buying.
They're buying a lot of edibles and high THC flower. There isn't anything else available.
Stinson says when the shop runs out of product, they won't be able to get more until the end of February at the earliest. She thinks the business won't begin breaking even until May. Still, she doesn't flinch, saying it's been worth it to get to this day.
We're so excited. We're so excited because so many people are congratulating us and have been waiting for it.
Stinson says her biggest concern now is that a Justice Department under nominee Senator Jeff Sessions could change federal policies towards cannabis, throwing the state market back into turmoil. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The issue of money in politics got a lot of media attention this summer when Republican Representative Gabrielle Ledoux formed Gabby's Tuesday PAC. It's the first political action committee in Alaska controlled by an individual legislator. Former Alaska Senate President Kevin Meyer is going after PACs like Ledoux's in what he says is an effort to improve public trust. KTOO's Carolyn Halter reports.
Republican Senator Kevin Meyer hopes to change Alaska's campaign finance law to address PACs controlled by individual lawmakers and candidates.
So Senate Bill 5 will close the loophole that allows lobbyists to contribute to political action groups that are controlled by a legislator or candidate for the legislature, and places a restriction on when these groups can engage in political fundraising.
Under Alaska's 1996 campaign finance law, candidates and elected officials are not allowed to receive contributions from lobbyists outside their home district, and they are not allowed to fundraise during the legislative session. SB 5 would extend these same rules to PACs controlled by individual legislators. PACs like Representative Ledoux's cannot contribute to the candidate or the legislator that controls them, but Meyer says that it's the appearance of impropriety that worries him.
The intent is to eliminate the appearance of any undue influence or corruption, and we must do everything we can to maintain and keep the trust, the public's trust.
Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski is a strong proponent of campaign finance reform. He supports Meyer's bill in principle, but thinks it could go much further.
If we're concerned that lobbyists giving money to legislators is a problem, there's probably some other areas that we need to close in the system. For example, what if a lobbyist gives money to his wife and then lets the wife write checks to, or husband, and then lets the husband or wife write checks to the legislator? Should that be allowed? What about lobbyists giving money to political parties and then having political parties give money to legislators? Should that be allowed?
Willikowski is actively working on an amendment to SB 5 to make it more comprehensive. A lot has been made of the Gabby's Tuesday PAC, but Representative Ledoux has pushed back, saying it's no different than PACs run by state political parties. Ledoux and two other Republicans joined forces with 17 Democrats and two independents to form a new majority in the House this year. It's the first time since 1993 that the chamber's top position will not be held by a Republican. Ledoux refused to speculate about the underlying motivations of Meyer's bill, but she did acknowledge the shifting power dynamics between individual lawmakers and political parties.
I think sometimes the parties have too much influence in politics. And so if more people had individual PACs, that could kind of curtail some of the influence that the parties had on people.
Senate Bill 5 is scheduled for public testimony at its next hearing in the Senate State Affairs Committee on Thursday. In Juneau, I'm Caroline Halter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Juneau's privately owned electric utility is trying to plan for a future that includes more electric cars. It's estimated there are more than 100 fully electric vehicles in the city. Even Teslas, the Porsche of electric vehicles, have been spotted in the capital city. As this new reality sets in, the state's regulatory commission is taking a closer look. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Juneau's car dealerships don't sell fully electric vehicles, or EVs. There's no tax break for buying one here, like in Washington State. But Devin Kibbe, the president of Juneau's Electric Vehicle Association, says that hasn't slowed the momentum.
Even without these incentives, people are still buying electric vehicles.
And Juneau's electric utility, Alaska Electric Light and Power, or AELNP, is trying to figure out a way to incentivize those drivers to charge at night. That's when the least amount of electricity is being used, so the cars are less of a burden on the grid. In November, the utility filed a request with the state's regulatory commission to offer a cheaper rate to electric vehicle owners who plug in during those times. It was a program they could opt into.
It's not necessarily that it's a bad deal, and by no means is a bad deal, but we're just wondering if there's another way to allocate the benefits to better help EV adoption in Juneau.
In January, the state's regulatory commission approved AELNP's nighttime charging rate, but the agency is also investigating how the utility makes those decisions. Kibbe says the Electric Vehicle Association wants a seat at the table, too. They want to ensure the best framework is being created to support the growing number of electric vehicles. Kibbe thinks the utility should offer the same nighttime charging rates like its previous experimental program, and provide affordable energy from public fast charging stations during the day.
One of the things that I think often comes up when we deal with incentive rate programs is the concern that all customers are treated fairly.
That's Alec Mezdag, a director at AELNP. The fast chargers can juice a Nissan Leaf in about 20 minutes, lessening the dreaded range anxiety. With a typical charger, there are 10 of those in town, that can take about 4 hours. The utility's Washington-based parent company, Avista, has installed fast chargers down south. But Mezdag says Washington has a very different regulatory environment than Alaska. Namely, the Washington legislature passed a bill making it okay for the utility to pass on that expense to ratepayers. And even though there are several electric vehicles in Juneau, Mezdag says that doesn't mean there's the same type of demands as other cities.
What we don't have in Juneau is a very large number of people who would need to utilize that infrastructure. The current owners of electric vehicles find it more convenient to charge at home because they typically have off-street parking.
Mezdag thinks there's still a lot to learn as more electric vehicles cruise into town. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska is trying to navigate the new environment, too. Its next meeting on the matter is Friday, February 10th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Defending champion Hugh Neff and past winners Brent Sass and Alan Moore are pushing the pace at the front of the Yukon Quest sled dog race. Leaders rested at Stepping Stone today, 285 miles into the race, which started Saturday in Whitehorse. As KYC's Molly Reddig reports, trail conditions are allowing fast travel.
Sunday was the perfect day for dog mushing in Yukon territories. It was 3 degrees below zero when Hugh Neff crossed the Yukon River in the blinding sunshine and stopped in Carmacks, 170 miles into the race. He knelt down next to his dogs and removed booties while they snacked on frozen salmon chunks.
Doing there, Rosie? How you doing, amigo?
Neff was first into Carmacks but had a bumpy start to the race when he hit a tricky turn about 12 miles out of Whitehorse. There was a hard right turn, then a quick left. But on the inside corner of the second turn was a big tree, and on the right side of the trail, a steep bank.
Tree right on the corner, so if you put your brake to slow down going down the hill, you're going to hit that tree hard, so you have to let off the brake a little bit, and all of a sudden the whole team's going over a cliff, and the trail's not wide at all, and I went with it, sled flipped over, I'm like, oh my god.
His sled got tangled up with another musher, Paige Drobny. A third musher, Gaetan Pirard, helped get them both upright, and Neff continued down the hill.
Hit a tree, I bounced off, hit another tree, they broke the carabiner that connects the sled to the dogs, and there goes my dog team. And fortunately, there's lots of people right down there at the bottom on the river.
Someone held onto his team until he could drag the sled over. All the dogs were fine, but Neff was a little banged up. As the CarMax Recreation Center filled up with teams Sunday afternoon, mushers said the trail was one of the fastest they'd seen. Alan Moore said it was almost too fast.
Can't get much faster. I mean, it's like a skating rink in most places.
At the earlier checkpoint in Braeburn, about 40 minutes down the Klondike Highway, the dog yard was full. Laura Neese attached a bale of straw to the top of her sled with a bungee cord as the sun climbed over the surrounding mountains. She said the run from Whitehorse was an adventure.
You're really beautiful. Yeah. Delightful. There are a couple sections of the first run where a lot of us were tipping. You could see just a trail of stuff everywhere.
So she was happy to be doing the next section during daylight. On the way to CarMax, mushers passed through the chain of lakes, a long section of lakes with a variety of portages in between.
And they're usually pretty twisty, turny, straight down drops and up. They're really fun if you're ready for them.
This year, her boss is running it too. Ed Steelstra runs the Mushing Kennel in Michigan, where Neese lives and trains.
I'm in awe of her. She is a racing phenom. She's going to do things in this sport that I never even had desire to do.
That's part of the reason Steelstra is here, to help Neese build a dog team for future races and to thank her for being such a good employee.
She lives in one of our old dog trucks because it's the closest thing to the kennel. I don't think people know that. I mean, we have four cabins on our properties. She lives in an old box truck.
While Steelstra has run the Iditarod several times before, this is his first quest, and he's expecting a challenge.
The quest, there's very little opportunity for shelter compared to Iditarod. So, I mean, arguably, that makes the quest harder. It's darker, it's colder, it's we go over mountain summits, for crying out loud here.
On Sunday night, mushers ran north on a fast trail under clear, cold skies, with hundreds of miles ahead of them. On the Yukon Quest Trail in CarMax, I'm Molly Reddig.
Finally tonight, a correction. In a story we aired on Friday about budget conversations over beer and ice cream in Juneau, we misidentified attorney Cliff Groh. He is a former assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins, Caroline Halter, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Molly Reddick in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.